line from Mikoa Tap, the entire team in the capital Tap on. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alamin la sharika lah wa bidhalika umirtu wa ana awwalul muslimin.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran once again says its defense program is non-negotiable and that every country has the right to build a strong deterrent force. The British Prime Minister says French threats over fishing row with London are completely unjustified as he refuses to rule out triggering a Brexit dispute at all next week. We will have a report from Paris, where yellow vest protesters take to the streets for the third consecutive week to reject their government's economic policies. Welcome to the program. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister says no country has the right to talk about Iran's defense capabilities. Ali Bagheri Kani has rejected U.S. attempts to link the Vienna talks on a revival of the nuclear deal with Iran's defense program. Bagheri Kani stated that every country has the right to build a strong deterrent force, and Iran is entitled to develop its own defense capabilities. He noted that Iran's defense power is aimed at ensuring national interests and security. Bagheri Kani made the remarks in an interview with Russia Today in response to the hostess' question about certain attempts to link the talks on the 2015 nuclear deal to Iran's missile program. He said progress in the Vienna talks depends on a strong will to accept the removal of cruel and illegal sanctions imposed on Iran. Political analyst David Yagubian says U.S. President Joe Biden's administration refuses to show goodwill regarding the revival of the JCPOA.
Well, unfortunately, one of the last remaining tools in the imperial tool bag of the United States is sanctions. And the United States is clearly just addicted to sanctions. Its efforts at occupation, regime change, color revolution, those continued by the Biden administration that were either initiated or perpetuated by the Trump administration. And so this is really all the Biden administration has. And unfortunately, it is refusing to show goodwill on the eve of potential re-engagement in Vienna regarding the JCPOA by issuing yet another round of sanctions, this time against four individuals and two entities related to Iran's UAV program. I agree with Ali Bagheri Kani regarding the the say necessity for nations to respect other nations and their conventional defensive capabilities. But I do have to say that some nations, based on their historical track record and their lack of aggression, I think have very good reason to be concerned about the military developments in neighboring nations. And just briefly, Iran, having not attacked a foreign country in almost 300 years.
Iran has urged Sweden to review the United Nations Human Rights Council's report about the impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iranians' right to health. Secretary General of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, made the call in a response to a Swedish foreign minister who had criticized Iran's human rights record. The HRC report details how the overcompliance of a Swedish bandage maker company with the sanctions has affected Iranian children with EB, an extremely painful and life-threatening skin condition. Iran says the U.S. sanctions violate human rights as they target the health care and welfare of ordinary people, especially women and children. Britain says it may trigger a trade dispute rule against France in a deepening row over post-Brexit fishing rights. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he may trigger dispute resolution measures in the trade and the cooperative agreements next week. This would involve convening an arbitration panel and could result in a demand for compensation or suspension of obligations. Johnson has also complained to European Union Chief Ursula von der Leyen that French threats over fishing are completely unjustified and are not compatible with the Brexit deal. On Wednesday, France detained one British fishing boat and issued warning to another one in its waters. Paris said the detained boat lacked proper license and its captain will face trial next August. Thousands of people march in Rome during the G20 summit calling for action against climate change and fair access to COVID-19 vaccines. The demonstrators waved flags and chanted, "We rise up," in an apparent warning against G20 leaders. They demand the attending top officials make headway on tackling global warming. Protest follows calls by the UN Secretary General. Antonio Guterres has urged those attending the summit to show more ambition, take action, and overcome mistrust in order to advance climate goals. Climate change is among the issues topping the G20 agenda. Political commentator Ahmed El-Touni believes any climate summit that does not address capitalism and neoliberalism will not be functional.
Any summit that takes place regarding climate change that doesn't address capitalism and neoliberal economics, it can't be taken seriously at all. Because at the end of the day, as long as you can turn water into profit, trees into profit, oil and minerals into profit, you're going to have climate change. We're going to have climate catastrophe, and that's what's taking place right now. So the idea that 20 countries that are hoarding the majority of the world's wealth coming together to try to solve this problem, of course it's going to be laughable, and of course they can do a lot more. What they can do is they can change completely this economic system and put people, peace, and planet before profit, but none of them are saying. They're talking about ideas that would have been sufficient in the 1980s, and they're trying to apply it now in 2021. So obviously they could do a lot more, but that would mean taking money out of the pockets of the wealthy, and none of them want to talk about that. For us in the Green Party, we believe in a Green New Deal that distributes equitably amongst the workers, that puts people and planet and peace above profit, and thinks more about the long-term sustainability as opposed to just constant unsustainable growth. And that's kind of what the problem is with having these countries present themselves in this way, because they're not saving anything. Perhaps they're saving face, but they're not saving the planet yet. It's just a show.
In France, the Yellow Vests protested in urban centers and rural roundabouts for the third consecutive week, that is indicating to many that they are back to being a weekly fixture of France's political scene. Here's a report from Paris.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the yellow vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media, but the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the yellow vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The yellow vests often march in several different groups in Paris, but they share essentially the same reasons for protesting. The yellow vests began 3 years ago in response to record high gas prices. Around Europe, energy prices have just exploded to new records. However, there is even more economic difficulty and instability now than when the yellow vests first took to the streets.
Inflation is at its highest point since 2008. Back then, unemployment was 30% lower than it is today. Economic growth is widely expected to slow dramatically from this quarter onwards. The era of austerity has left France economically unprepared for the coronavirus era, and many believe that social unrest could return to the shocking levels of 2019.
En Tunisie, etc.
I think what you're seeing is similar to the revolutions which began in Tunisia and swept the Arab world. The abuse of human liberty by our government is provoking the same type of conditions in France. They say that there is no more yellow vests. It's not true. We are right here and living on our feet instead of dying on our knees.
French media coverage of the yellow vests diminished to almost nothing in May of 2019. Just 3 weeks into season two, seemingly no domestic media witnessed the demonstrations in Paris. Contrarily, there continues to be an overwhelming police presence of seemingly one heavily armed riot cop for every two protesters, increasing the chances for provocation and violence against unarmed protesters. Amin Mazahiri, Paris.
COVID continues to take its toll on Europe, with several countries reporting a surge in infections and related deaths. Russia is bracing for nationwide curbs this week, as it reports its highest single-day case tally, 40,000 new infections. They also say, or the country, actually also logged over 1,100 daily deaths. Russia's overall death toll is currently the highest in Europe. Britain, meanwhile, has reported 166 more fatalities and over 41,000 new daily infections. More than 140,000 people have died from COVID in the UK. In Eastern Europe, death cases in Ukraine have been hitting record highs in the past few days. The country logged more than 26,000 new cases and a further 541 deaths over the past day. In other news, Damascus has strongly denounced the Turkish decision to extend its military presence on Syrian soil. A Syrian foreign ministry source told local media that the Turkish move amounts to a military aggression and violates UN resolutions. The source regards Turkey's policy as a threat to regional peace and security. This, less than a week after the Turkish parliament voted to extend for two more years the military's mandate to launch cross-border operations in Iraq and Syria. Ankara says its mission is aimed at fighting terrorists, but Damascus has time and again condemned the Turkish presence on its soil and accused Turkey supporting terrorist groups. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams Israel's UN envoy Gilad Erdan for tearing up the UN Human Rights Council's yearly report at a General Assembly meeting. Hamas spokesman Abdul Latif Al-Ghanu said Erdan's action shows the arrogant behavior of the regime toward international organizations. He also called on the UN to take deterrent and punitive measures against Israel's crimes. Ono said the international community should prevent double standards toward Palestine. He stressed that the Israeli regime should be brought to justice for what he called crimes against humanity. This comes after Erdogan mimicked the gesture of former Israeli ambassador Chaim Herzog, who did the same in 1975 when the UN declared Zionism a form of racism. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has denounced as a show of weakness a decision by Riyadh and its regional allies to recall the ambassadors to Lebanon amid a row over the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Republic of Yemen welcomes this position and all other clear positions which confirm that what is happening in Yemen is aggression. It's normal because it's been going on for 7 years. Withdrawing their ambassadors shows weakness for countries that took such a measure, and they should not do that, as it indicates that foolishness is what runs the Saudi regime.
A Yemeni official was referring to the kingdom and its allies' reaction to recent criticism by Lebanon's information minister of the Saudi-led war on Yemen. George Kordahi had called the aggression futile and demanded an end for it. He had also said Yemen's Ansarullah forces are only defending their country against external aggression. Saudi Arabia and its allies have taken a series of punitive measures against Lebanon over Kordahi's remarks. Kuwait has ordered Lebanon's chargé d'affaires to leave the country. The UAE has decided to withdraw its diplomats from Lebanon and ban its citizens from visiting the country.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese information minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha. Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime designated six leading Palestinian human rights groups, terrorist organizations, but refused to reveal any evidence to prove the accusation. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Robert Mackey, journalist. This article is published under the heading Palestinian Rights Groups That Document Israeli Abuses, Labeled Terrorists by Zionist Regime. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. were signed by the Zionist regime's war minister recently, designated six leading Palestinian human rights groups terror organizations, marking an escalation in the Zionist regime's effort to deprive independent agencies that document Zionist military abuses in the occupied territories of funding from U.S. foundations and European nations. The Zionist regime law criminalizes providing funds to groups designated as terrorist organizations and authorizes the police to prevent activities by or in support of terrorist organizations, including organizing meetings, marches, or training. The rights groups uniformly rejected the charge made in an unsigned statement from the Zionist regime's Internal Security Service and its Bureau of Counter-Terror Financing that all six are secretly run by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which carried out bombings and hijackings starting in late 1960s. The rights activists, branded terrorists by the war minister Benny Gantz, work on a range of uniformly peaceful civil society projects to improve life in the occupied territories run by the Zionist regime's military. The six groups are Defense for Children International Palestine, which defends Palestinian children in the Israeli regime military courts and has documented abuses and killings by the Zionist forces. Al-Haq, which documents violations of Palestinians' rights in the West Bank and is an affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists in Geneva. ADEMIR, Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which advocates for Palestinian political prisoners held in the Zionist regime and Palestinian prisons. The Union of Agricultural Work Committees, that is UAWC, an agricultural development group. The Bisson Center for Research and Development, an academic institute whose Ramallah offices were raided by the Zionist regime forces in July, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, a women's rights organization. Shawan Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, was jailed by the Zionist regime in 1980s for his alleged ties to the Popular Front, a charge he denied at the time and rejected again in an interview with the New York Times. "This is a false claim completely," Jabarin said. He added that his group was being tarred by the Zionist regime for working to have its abuses tried by the International Criminal Court. Hale Ghazmar, the General Director of Defense for Children International Palestine, said in a statement, "We reject the recent designation as another unjust action by Zionist regime authorities to criminalize and eliminate our lawful human rights and child protection work. We defend Palestinian children in the Israeli regime military courts and expose grave violations against Palestinian children at the hands of Israeli forces. When years of delegitimization and disinformation campaigns against us have failed to silence our work, Israeli authorities choose to now escalate repressive tactics by labeling civil society organizations and terrorists." Defense for Children International Palestine is one of several groups that have been subjected to raids and harassment from Zionist regime troops enforcing military rule in the occupied West Bank this year. The group's documentation of abuse by both Zionist regime forces and settlers has drawn international attention to the brutality of the open-ended military occupation. Criticism of the Zionist regime attack on the rights groups came from their supporters and partners in Palestine, the occupied territories and abroad, including some members of Congress. "Silencing, intimidating, and criminalizing Palestinian civil society organizations and human rights defenders are Israel's way of covering up its abuses while maintaining its impunity, the veteran Palestinian negotiator Hanan Ashrabi tweeted, adding, "It's the occupation that must be held to account. If a regime designates human rights organizations terroristic, then that tells all those wavering minds all they need to know about the values," said the regime. Tariq Bakani, a former analyst for International Crisis Group, observed, "It also, by the way, reveals the regime's deep insecurity." Matt Doss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, said, "Labeling human rights groups as terrorists is a very typical move of authoritarian regimes, which the occupation is, and a prelude to increased repression." A State Department spokesperson, Ned Price, was more guarded, telling reporters, "We will be engaging our Israeli partners for more information regarding the basis for these designations." Israel did not give a U.S. advance warning that they would be designated, unquote. Progressive members of Congress were more outspoken in their outrage at designation. Representative Betty McCollum, a Minnesota Democrat, noted the important role of Defense for Children International Palestine in her effort to ban the Israeli regime from using military assistance it receives from the United States of America to pay for the detention, interrogation, or torture of Palestinian children living in the occupied West Bank. Representative Mark Pocan, a Wisconsin Democrat, wrote on Twitter, "Israel should rescind their blanket decision to label Palestinian civil rights organizations as terrorist groups. Many of these organizations are working to bring peace in the region. The apartheid regime's labeling of award-winning human rights groups as terrorist organizations just because they speak truth about Israeli violence and human rights impact is grossly anti-democratic and dangerous." Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American Democrat from Michigan, tweeted, adding, "The U.S. must end funding for human rights abuses. Enough." As Diala Shamas, a human rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, observed on Twitter, "The order criminalizes groups. Israeli regime has tried and failed to cut funding for decades." While concealing all evidence to support his claims, the Zionist regime made no secret of its determination to cut off funding from international organizations for these groups, which make it more difficult to conceal the abusive nature of the occupation that has kept millions of Palestinians under military rule for 54 years. The statement from the Israeli regime claimed that the declared organizations received large sums of money from European countries and international organizations using a variety of forgery and deceit ways and diverted it from good works to a terrorist group. The absence of any proof of that led some close observers to speculate that the decision might have been based on research done by a hyper-partisan Zionist group's NGO Monitor, which has successfully lobbied foreign donors to cut funding to Palestinian rights groups by claiming some of their employees are connected to Palestinian political parties with armed wings. NGO Monitor is an extremist group which entire purpose is attacking Israeli-Palestinian-U.S. human rights civil society groups based on false information and tenuous connections. Rabbi Jill Jacobs, the director of Torah, the rabbinic call for human rights, tweeted recently as the Zionist group gloated, adding, "The report should not be trusted." The Zionist regime's anger at European nations for providing financial and material backing to Palestinian civil society and rights groups has simmered for decades. In 2017, reporters overhauled the Zionist regime's then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, telling the leaders of Hungary, the Czech Republic, Poland, and Slovakia that it was crazy for the European Union to insist that the Israeli regime honor Article 2 of an association agreement signed in 1995, which makes trade with the Bloc conditional on the Israeli regime's respect for human rights and democratic principles. The late historian Tony Judt had explained in 2010 that economic and cultural ties to Europe were of vital importance to the fake regime of Israel.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Communique. 7 people were shot dead and dozens more wounded in the Lebanese capital Beirut after snipers belonging to the Lebanese Forces militia opened fire at a peaceful protest led by Hezbollah and Amal protesters. In the mainstream media, they've called them clashes. Many Lebanese accuse them of purposely hiding or obfuscating the identities of the victims and even of blaming Hezbollah for the violence. So were these just clashes, as some in the media have suggested, or something more sinister aimed at provoking a reaction from Hezbollah, an escalation, and dragging Lebanon into a civil war? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. October 14th, 7 people were martyred and dozens more wounded after snipers opened fire at protesters in Beirut's Tayuna district. The majority of the victims, supporters of Hezbollah and its ally, the Amal movement, who gathered outside the Palace of Justice. Intended as a peaceful, unarmed protest, Hezbollah called for the demonstration the day before to protest against a judge named Tariq Bitar, who people accuse of politicizing the investigation into the Beirut port explosion. Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar reported that the American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, was attempting to frame Hezbollah for the explosion and influence the investigation. As protesters gathered outside the Palace of Justice, sniper fire began to erupt as gunmen on the surrounding buildings began firing at the protesters from rooftops and other vantage points. After the violence erupted, the armed wings of these groups then arrived with weapons to defend the protesters. And I think this is a very important point to understand, because some people in the Western mainstream media and Lebanese media have referred to the massacre as a clash, implying an exchange of fire between two sides. But is that really how things went down? Because when snipers start shooting at protesters, that's an ambush. It's an attack. It's not a clash, which would require both sides to be fighting from the start. Now, some people have also posted videos online saying, look, you see, the protesters were armed. Hezbollah and Amal, they brought weapons to the protest. They asked for it. But this is, again, untrue. One of the martyrs was a mother waiting at the window for her children to come home from school. She wasn't even at the protest, let alone carrying a weapon. How do you explain her death? The demonstration that took place was live streamed. There are tons of videos and photographs showing very clearly that no one was armed. You can see here, as the shooting begins, there isn't a single weapon in the entire shot. The videos of people carrying weapons are from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed protesters. It's only then that people came from nearby districts in order to defend the protesters. So that's a completely different story and a very important distinction to make. All the victims had head wounds, indicating a clear intent to kill. Not to deter, nor disperse, nor defend, or whatever other excuse the apologists for this massacre have concocted. The Lebanese army even put out a tweet confirming that protesters had been shot at. They didn't say that armed groups or personnel were shot at, they said protesters. The Minister of Interior also confirmed that this was indeed a massacre, an ambush, and not some clash. Of course, some people in the media, they don't even want to disclose the identity of the victims. Hezbollah is always the bad guy, according to them. So when Hezbollah supporters are being massacred in broad daylight, this runs counter to their usual narrative. And if you look at the various headlines in the press, you can see how they use this passive language to avoid telling the truth. If you read their headlines, you would never know what actually happened and who was shot at. So they're basically lying about what happened, either calling it a clash or trying to obfuscate the identity of the victims. And we know that the victims are mostly Hezbollah and Amal supporters, so what about the perpetrators? Who was behind the attack? Well, the Lebanese army has so far arrested a total of 19 people in connection with the attack. It is widely assumed that a right-wing Christian militia and a rival of Hezbollah, known as the Lebanese Forces, they were behind the massacre. And if you knew anything about the history of the Lebanese Forces and the history of their leader, Samir Jaja, this would hardly surprise you. As a matter of fact, this recent attack pales in comparison with their other atrocities when they killed scores of Christians, Muslims, Palestinians, Armenians. Not only that, but during the Lebanese Civil War, the Lebanese Forces militia committed treason and collaborated with Israel, an invading and occupying force, to carry out these attacks. They received funding, clothing, and weapons from the Israelis. And in September 1982, together, they committed one of the most horrific massacres, murdering 3,500 Palestinians and Lebanese Shia in Beirut. The leader of the Lebanese Forces militia, Samir Jaja, was also found guilty of assassinating the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rashid Karami, in 1987, and Danish Amoun in 1990. Today, Jaja also enjoys funding and support from Saudi Arabia and the United States, who have a vested interest in fracturing Lebanon and weakening Hezbollah. One of the victims, Mohammed Tamer, is reported to have been killed not by the Lebanese Forces militia, but actually by the Lebanese army. The authenticity of CCTV footage posted online appeared to be confirmed when the Lebanese army said that the soldier in question is now under investigation. The scenes of this latest massacre in Beirut are a painful reminder to many of Lebanon's civil war, which lasted 15 years and took place on these very streets. It is with that in mind that Hezbollah and Amal released an official statement following the shooting, asking people to remain calm and refrain from retaliating to the murders, for fear of escalating the situation and dragging Lebanon into another civil war, which is perhaps what Jaja and his backers would very much like to do. To discuss more, I'm joined by Zainab El-Safar. She's an Iraqi-Lebanese journalist and the host of the television program Min Al-Dakhil, which airs weekly on El Mayadin. First of all, let me say thank you, Zainab, for coming on the program. It's great to finally have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So, Zainab, can you perhaps just walk us through what happened yesterday in Beirut? First of all, why were people outside? What were they protesting against? Who was protesting? And what is really the issue at hand?
At the night before, the eve before, there were certain kind of suspicious movements in the neighborhoods facing the place that the events took place yesterday. And this is something very suspicious because, you know, when such kind of movements, mobilizations take place by people in black and they are trying to secure certain kind of neighborhoods, avenues, and streets, and they were trying to deploy their militias over there, and the security forces and the various security forces, they didn't move an eye to all this kind of movement. We have to ask questions and we have to pose questions as, where is the preemptive security that ought to be there at certain points in time? So the next day, the people who were on the streets, let me just tell you and walk you through the events that took place. It is in repercussion to the politicizing of the judge that is in charge of the probe of the Beirut blast that occurred last year on the 4th of August. This particular judge, this unfortunately, we tend to call them justice, but there is no justice in what they are doing. His measures are so discretionary and politicized to the sense that he wanted to deviate the probe from its ultimate aims. And he issued certain kind of subpoenas and orders that were really so suspicious. They were highly politicized. There is no kind of justice or order in whatever he was doing. So the people took to the streets, civilians, unarmed, peaceful demonstrators, people who belong to the elite of Lebanon, lawyers, engineers, teachers. They took to the streets and they were unarmed. Okay, so what happened is that the moment they took to the streets at 10:45 a.m. exactly, fire, sniper fire, heavy, a salvo of sniper fire were started to shoot in their direction. We had seven martyrs, among them a woman, Maryam Farhat. She's the mother of five. I cannot just put them into words and say what has happened. It's like a kind of dragging the people. The events, you know, if you just want to paint the picture, they were so much reminiscent of what took place, what instigated the Lebanese Civil War back in 1975. The place and the way the events were taking place and escalating. 4 hours of intense gunfire, incessant gunfire. What does that mean? And nothing happened to stop them.
When you mention this poor woman who was killed in her home and, you know, the protesters were unarmed, I mean, this is a very important point because you have a lot of people posting videos, people online saying that the protesters were armed, that they came to the protest with weapons. Is that true? Or were those videos from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed some of the protesters in front of the Palace of Justice?
Unfortunately, Richard, a lot of media outlets, local media outlets and foreign media outlets, are accomplices in the crime that took place against the people, the innocent people of demonstration. The way they were trying to promote that this matter has boiled down into clashes. Clashes take place between two sides. But this is, you know, the Lebanese forces, militias, those lunatic mercenaries, performing, perpetrating this massacre, this intended, pre-planned, pre-orchestrated, and perpetrated massacre against civilians. They were trying to show that the matter is only a kind of clashes, you know, an action and a reaction. No way. Nobody. We said and we underscored the fact that those protesters were unarmed and were peaceful, And they were from the elite, as I said. Those people, they shot at a demonstration, demonstrators, they shot back and there was an exchange of fire. This was not the case at all. Only the army, you know, deployed, and they deployed their armored personnel, and they were trying to take hold of the situation, 4 hours of intense fire, until they tried to apprehend those perpetrators, and 8 of them are apprehended, and they said that, well, they admitted what they were doing.
What did you make of not just local commentators, but international media portraying it as, you know, a fight between two sides, and omitting the victims, that they're Hezbollah and Amal supporters, from the headlines, the subheadings, you know, it just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of, you know, it's part also of the whole choir of trying to show that, well, you know, it's the beginning, the flames of a civil war that is has just erupted and is going to burn Lebanon. It's between a Christian side, you know, and even in the geography, Ain al-Rumani, you say Christian side, populated by the Christians, and then you say Ash-Shia and Tayuni, it's populated by the Shia mostly, and you say that, well, it's a kind of civil war between the Christians and the Shia, Amal and Hezbollah, they represent the greatest number of Shia in Lebanon, but this was not that, and this is what they want to sell because, you know, as we all know, that Hezbollah has a very deep-rooted alliance with the Free Patriotic Movement, which is one of the biggest Christian parties in Lebanon. And also, Amal Movement has also alliance with the Merida. Hezbollah has also with the Merida. They are all Christians. And they are also people who suffered from the massacres perpetrated by the Lebanese forces against their own people, the Christians, their fellow Christians themselves. The Lebanese forces, party, and militia, what they were doing is what they have always been doing, what they are used to be doing. They are mercenaries in the hands of those who pay the higher bid. You know, they are funded by certain Arab regimes, and they take the orders from the Americans, and they perpetrate massacres. We don't, it does not escape us ever, you know, what happened in Sabra and Shatila, and who was responsible for what happened in Sabra and Shatila, where 3,500 people, innocent Palestinians and Lebanese, at least 80 people from Al-Muqdad family, they have been assassinated in a mode which is, they have been butchered. Women, children, elderly, they have been butchered in the Sabra neighborhood, just adjacent to the Shatila refugee camp.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Lebanese army, they arrested members of this Christian militia, the Lebanese forces, for this attack. But it's not really out of place for them, is it? I mean, they have a whole history of this barbarism, let's call it what it is, this barbarism against all various walks of life in Lebanon, as you mentioned. And I think it's really important for people to understand what they are. You know, it's really astonishing for me that someone like Zsa Zsa is a free man. It's really unconscionable, isn't it?
Yes, he was given amnesty back in 2005, and then you know how events escalated back in 2005 with the assassination of the slain Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and then how Lebanon went into this kind of, you know, those events that the aim and target of which was to target the resistance in Lebanon. Then you had 2006, which is the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. But, you know, whoever stood in the face of the resistance has always been defeated. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is part and parcel of the fabric. It is a community. It has a large swathe of constituency. And we have to understand something, speaking of constituency, is that we are very soon approaching the elections in Lebanon, the parliamentary elections, and whatever we see, any kind of instability, any kind of event, is going to be in order to try and tip the balance of elections, because the Lebanese forces, they know for sure that, you know, former member of parliament Walid Jumblat is no longer allying with them in Baabda and Ashouf, and he said so clearly. And also, Al-Hariri, which is the future bloc, is not aligned with them in the Akkar region, in the Hirmil, and somewhere else. So they are, according to this new electoral law, they'll be losing a lot of seats in the forthcoming elections. And whatever they have done, Richard, they opened their own fire at themselves. This is not something that is going to pass easily. The blood of the martyrs is not going to stay on the streets. There's going to be a kind of accountability, a solid accountability, a vendetta also, not only from those particular people, the way, you know, those people who were also responsible for the events that took place in Khaldi and the killing, the cold blood killing of the people in Khaldi, and those who were also the next day in the funeral procession. Their masters, who are the servants of another master, which is a master that was and is always defeated today, defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq, defeated in Syria, defeated elsewhere, is also going to be defeated in Lebanon, Richard, sooner rather than later.
Zainab, when you speak of their masters, this is a very important point. What role do the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, what role do they play in this attack and in Lebanese politics in general? Is it true, for example, that the Lebanese forces militia was training in Saudi Arabia? You know, what else is the American embassy, what role does the American ambassador play in all this? And what goal are they trying to achieve here? You mentioned destabilizing the elections as one example. Is this also part of a plan to weaken the axis of resistance, to disarm Hezbollah? What about Lebanon's gas and natural resources?
Of course, everything that the Americans have been doing in the region and also in Lebanon in particular, the sanctions against Lebanon, the sanctions against lots of personalities who are allied with the resistance in Lebanon, it's a mode of trying to weaken the resistance in Lebanon and trying to turn the people of Lebanon, the people of the resistance, against their own resistance. And, you know, the American ambassador has been doing all this witchcraft, if I might say, all these kind of suspicious and all these kind of, you know, the imperial moves trying to control Lebanon and the Lebanese institutions, but she's failing. And, you know, the moment Hezbollah tried to get the ship of fuel from Iran, the next day she said that, well, we're going to get gas from Egypt through Syria. Syria that was sanctioned by the very Americans through the Caesar law. They broke the Caesar law, and, you know, and she was reprimanded by her administration, saying that, well, you don't need this Sayyid Nasrallah to do something, and then you have to retaliate the next day to show that you are strong and flexing your muscles. But anyways, she is doing her best. She is on the line of the Pompeo recommendations, still trying to, in her dreams, she dreams a lot that she dreams of disbanding and disarming Hezbollah and, you know, dismantling this kind of party and the people of it, and turning the people of the resistance and the quote-unquote Shia against Hezbollah. Well, this is just in your dreams. These are chimeras, and this is something that can never be true. Regarding the fact that we heard yesterday a very important statement by the mother of the martyr, Maryam Farhat, in yesterday's events, in the massacre that took place yesterday. She said, well, they are not going to move us one iota against the resistance. We know those scenarios. We know the play, this theatrical thing that is taking place against us. We know the ultimate aims of, and we're not going to move. That's why the people of Lebanon yesterday, and I say the people of Lebanon, the true, honest people of Lebanon, they were not being dragged to a kind of civil war, to a kind of sedition, to a kind of discord, because whatever took place, it's not so much strange to us. We know these scenarios, and nobody can drag us again to a civil war.
Zainab Al-Safar, thank you so much for your time. It's really a pleasure having your insightful knowledge and graceful presentation on the program. Really great speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communicate.
is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
In order to understand the Tayuni massacre that just took place in Beirut, we have to understand the general context of Lebanon's political situation. As we've covered before on the program, Lebanon is under a de facto U.S. siege, its economy in turmoil, and as such, Lebanon remains a very fragile nation in need of political reform. As of recently, Hezbollah has been importing shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon, defying not only U.S. sanctions, but also its political rivals inside the country, making them look weak and incompetent, as Hezbollah bolsters its image and popularity with the Lebanese people. There are elections coming up soon in Lebanon, and political parties like Jaja's Lebanese forces want to manipulate public opinion against Hezbollah because of their weak standing and the recent political humiliations that they saw. External actors like the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have been trying to dismantle Hezbollah for a long time, especially after Hezbollah successfully liberated South Lebanon from Israeli occupation and drove the Israeli invaders back in 2006. The aim of the Tayuni massacre was twofold. One, murdering its supporters to try and provoke Hezbollah into retaliation. The United States, Israel, and Hezbollah's rivals in Lebanon want to paint Hezbollah not as a resistance group, but as some violent armed gang. They want to paint it as an organization that uses violence against its own people so they can try and disarm the group. That way, Hezbollah's political rivals can ascend to power inside Lebanon. The Israelis would no longer face any resistance